Well, we're privileged this morning to have Dr. Paul Chamberlain and his wife, Gail, with us. And I've known Dr. Chamberlain for a number of years. Some of you, actually, I found out in the early service, you had a childhood friend, or at least someone who grew up knowing your family. So some of you know Dr. Chamberlain for a long, long time, perhaps. But a couple years ago, we had Paul here with us, and he shared on some issues, some defense of our faith type of questions, and we enjoyed it so much and benefited so much from it that we decided to invite him back again today. And so Paul's going to come and share on a couple more questions throughout the weekend, and we're just thrilled. I don't want to take any more of his time other to say that we don't often give up our pulpit very easily around here, but it is a joy, an easy joy, to give this one over to you. And I'm going to ask Paul just to share a bit on the books that he's written,
okay, so
we can go and intelligently know which ones to buy,
okay.
And maybe a little on the sessions that you're going to present later today.
Sure will. Okay. Thank you, Don. Well, thank you so much for having us, folks. It's really wonderful to be here again, and I do recall very well being here a couple of years ago. I wasn't sure exactly when it was, but we had a great time here, and this is actually Don's and my third round. Because when Dawn and Linda were in Armstrong, we went there for a weekend once as well. Had a great time there together. But it is really a pleasure to be with you all back in the Okanagan. We love the Okanagan. We vacation here. We have friends up here. I've got family in Kelowna. And one thing I like about the Okanagan is that there's sunshine here. See, I was raised in Alberta. They call it sunny Alberta, which I didn't know why they call it there until I moved to Abbotsford, B.C. Then I realized that's why they call that sunny Alberta. Because in Abbotsford, B.C., we have sunshine, but it's normally called... We call liquid sunshine. You know what I call a Vancouver optimist? He's a person with a sun visor on his rain cap. That's a Vancouver optimist. And so that's what we live with out there. Listen, I really want to commend the church and Pastor Don and the leadership here for putting together a weekend like this, where we're devoting this to the issue of responding to secular perspectives on Christian faith. I just think there's very few things that are more important for us to think about from time to time to focus our thoughts on than that. As Don has mentioned, I teach at Trinity Western University. I've been there teaching over the years. I love to teach. I love students, and I love issues that we get to work with. And I direct something called an Institute for Christian Apologetics. Now, it's kind of a funny-sounding term, isn't it? Christian apologetics. What does it sound like you're doing when you're involved in Christian apologetics? I mean, it sounds like you're learning how to say, I'm sorry, I'm a Christian. I won't let that happen again. Or learning how to apologize for being Christians, or something along that line. The word apologize actually has two distinct meanings. One of them is to say, I'm sorry, I won't let that happen again. But the other means to defend whatever it is you're apologizing for. It's from an old Greek word, way back. In fact, it's a New Testament word. It's in the Bible, and it was used before that. One of Plato's dialogues is called the Apology, where Socrates gives a defense of himself before 500 of his own peers. That one didn't go too well for Socrates, if you've read that one, but that's what he was doing, giving a defense of himself. Well, Christian apologetics is all about the defense of Christian faith. And I tell our students all the time that I think one of the best ways to define it is that we're simply interested in learning how to present a Christian message to the people around us, our culture, in a way that is accurate, in a way that is relevant, in a way that is credible or defensible, or really scratches where people itch. And that's really what it's all about when we look at issue after issue. Why is it that some people find it difficult to embrace Jesus, to embrace Christianity? What are those issues? And can we focus in on those and think about those? And that's what we'll be doing in this weekend as well. In fact, let me just tell you a little bit about the issues that we are going to be talking about this weekend. Let me ask you, how many of you have thought about this question, wondered about it yourself? Can I live out and express my faith, my convictions as a Christian in this culture, without the people of our culture regarding me as intolerant? You ever wondered about that? I wonder what the answer to that question is. How about this question? What is true tolerance in the first place? We're using the term, calling people tolerant, calling other people intolerant, but what does this term mean in the first place? And how about this question? Are we even supposed to be tolerant in the first place? Is tolerance a worthy goal? Or is it just some kind of cultural idol that we have, that we focused in on? How about that question? And how about this other one, moving on to something different? Because we're going to be looking at that question, the one about tolerance, right after lunch. That's the first question we're going to address. Immediately following that one, we're going to get into this one, and maybe you've had this one put to you. Isn't morality morality a purely relative thing, a purely subjective relative thing? You ever had that question put to you? Or is it relative, or is it absolute and objective? Have you ever had anyone say this to you? Who are you to say your moral ideas are correct and others are wrong? Or are we even supposed to be saying things like that? What do we do with the issue of moral relativism in our culture? That's the second one we'll deal with this afternoon. It's a very foundational one, and one that affects many, many other issues beyond that. So it seems to me that one of those foundational ones we need to think about. That's for this afternoon. How about this for tomorrow evening? We're going to get into this question. Don't, and maybe you've heard this question put to you as well, don't all religions lead to God? Or true spirituality? I mean, I know you Christians feel like you think your way is the true way, but isn't that kind of arrogant? Isn't that kind of intolerant of other people's ways of finding God and spirituality and their own way? How about that question? That's probably one of the most common ones put in one of the underlying ways of thinking, prevailing ideas in our culture. And it comes down to this for us. How do we communicate Jesus in a pluralistic culture like ours, like we've always been called upon to do for the past 2,000 years? How do we do that in our culture? That's what we're going to be getting into tomorrow evening. And also tomorrow evening, this very sensitive one, isn't Christianity anti-gay? Anybody ever put that to you? Is Christianity anti-gay? Maybe you've had, isn't Christianity anti-this or anti-that? There's a whole bunch of things that can fill in that blank. But one of them sometimes is this. Isn't Christianity anti-gay? I find this to be an extremely sensitive topic at the moment in our culture. I don't think we as Christians are always navigating it very well. And so we're going to address that one tomorrow evening. So I guess the question that comes to my mind is, when we think about questions like this, when we hear questions like this, what do we do? Do we freeze up? Or do we look for a hole to crawl into? Or do we just say, oh, forget it, I don't want to get involved in those kind of discussions again. Those don't go well when I get involved in those ones. I find that to be one of the more tragic responses. Because one of the things that's been very exciting for me over the years is to face some of these questions squarely and discover that there are good, effective, helpful responses we can learn, we can think through. And some of them even encourage our own faith, our own walk with God, and they can provide assistance to others as well as they wrestle with the same kinds of questions. So I'd personally invite you tonight, and this afternoon I should say, and tomorrow evening to join. This evening we'll be with the young people here. But if you think you're going to have a lot of fun as you learn important things together, that's what we're going to be doing in these sessions this afternoon and tomorrow evening. We'll have handout notes. We'll have PowerPoint presentation to highlight key ideas along the way. We'll give chance for you to interact and participate and join in. So that's what we'll be doing. As Dawn has mentioned, I've had an opportunity over the years to address a number of issues through writing of books. I used to wonder when I was younger, I wonder if I'd ever get a chance to write a book. I thought that was kind of a dream I had. And I thought, then I began wondering, well, do we need more books? I looked around everywhere I went, in the libraries and people's shelves, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of books. Do we need one more? And then I got to Trinity Western. I remember in my first interview, my faculty interview, before I got the job, and they began talking about publishing and researching, the things that they require professors to do when they get jobs there. And one faculty member said, well, we don't actually use the term publish or perish, but that's pretty much the way it is around here. Now, that's kind of an odd way of saying that we do use the term publish or perish. Well, when I got here, I began to realize, okay, this is an opportunity. It's an opportunity I relished. And I hadn't been there for very long, and I was invited to participate in a debate with a UBC prof. And they called the debate, the title of this first book that I wrote, Can We Be Good Without God? And the debate was dealing with two issues. It was an atheist professor at UBC, and the debate we had dealt with the question, number one, is there such a thing as real, objective right and wrong, or is morality a purely relative thing? That was the first question. And both of us agreed in that debate that there is objective, absolute moral truth. The moral relativism was false. We both agreed with that. Which was interesting, it was a surprise to some people in the audience that the atheists would take that view as well. But many atheist philosophers take that same position. But then the second part of that was, assuming there is objective moral truth out there, absolute moral truth, is God required for it as a foundation? And of course, I argued yes to that, and of course, the atheist argued no to that, not believing there was a God in the first place. And it was a very good exchange, and I got back home, and I realized, well, there's more than just two views on that question. So that's what this book is. It's a dialogue between five different views, those two I mentioned, plus three more, on those same two questions. Can we be good without God? And that's what that book is. It wasn't too long after that I received a phone call inviting me to debate the Member of Parliament, Sven Robinson. Some of you will remember him. And he and I had two different debates together on the issue of physician-assisted suicide, and we've kind of maintained a friendship over the years. We email each other back and forth and actually do some favors for each other, if you can believe that. But it's actually been quite a nice friendship. He's always treated me and my family very well. But he had a starkly different position than I did on the issue of assisted suicide. He was crusading very hard for its legalization. And at the very same time as this was going on, I was teaching ethics at Trinity Western, and my own mother had multiple sclerosis, and she had it for 34 years, and I saw her go on and on and on, this advancing more and more and more until she died of it in 2003. And I watched this, and I thought, these are some of the exact same people who had come to a point where they sometimes say, just give me a lethal injection. Let's just get this over with. And other people campaign hard to have that legalized. Well, now, of course, as you know, in Canada, it has become legal. The Supreme Court struck down the prohibition in this just a short time back, and now we have a law making it legal. Well, that's what this book addresses. It's called Final Wishes, A Cautionary Tale on Death, Dignity, and Physician-Assisted Suicide. Addresses that issue and tries to bring out more sides to the issue than you normally hear in the media. And that's what the book is. It rolls out of those debates. Then there's this one here I'll mention, talking about good and bad without getting ugly. I'm not sure if you'd come up with these kind of catchy titles. I don't. This is the publisher comes up with this kind of thing. But this book here is all about addressing moral issues, the kind of issues that are sometimes dicey to address. And we don't want to talk with people. We don't want to get into discussions with them. But this book is all about, how do we do that? How do we carry on productive conversations on issues like that, issues of morality and issues of faith? For example, what do we do when someone says to us, you know, you have no right to impose your moral values on the rest of us? You're religious, right? You attend church, and you have your religious views. You can hold those, but you have no right to impose those on the rest of us. And this has very far-reaching consequences, that statement right there. And you wonder to yourself, well, is there some truth to that? It kind of sounds a little bit right, but something's wrong. Something sounds wrong with that as well. I mean, can we run any society without somebody imposing something on the rest of us? What are our laws if they aren't somebody's ideas of right and wrong imposed in some way? And so we have a chapter in the book entitled Thou Shalt Not Impose, and there's a number of other chapters like that on those kinds of issues. Then there's this one here, which addresses what I consider to be one of our pressing challenges to the Christian church today, and that is the idea that it's from a group of people, atheists, called New Atheists. They're different from the old-fashioned atheists in the sense that they have a strong conviction, a strong contention that religion, including Christianity, is not merely false and flawed and mistaken. It's actually dangerous. It's a force for evil in the world. It causes people to get involved in acts of terrorism, blowing up buses, flying planes into buildings. As Richard Dawkins, one of the most well-known atheists in the world today, probably the most well-known atheist, who's a very strong proponent of new atheism, likes to say, and he gets a great applause for saying it too, is when he gives speeches. One of the things I love about science, he says, because he is a scientist, is that it teaches us how to fly people to the moon. What I don't like about religion is it teaches us how to fly planes into buildings. Great applause. Now you say, any one of us can come up with a little, cute line like that. We could say something like this. You know what I don't like about science? It teaches us how to develop things like mustard gas and biological weapons and atomic weapons. You know what I love about religion? It produces people like Mother Teresa who give their whole life to go to India to help people who can't help themselves. You could say that too. Okay, these little lines don't really get you very far, because what you begin to realize is almost anything can be abused. And that's just one of the first principles you begin to realize as you begin to work through this. Well, this book is a response to new atheism. I took a time off at Trinity Western and just simply put myself in the shoes of these folks, try to understand where they're coming from and responded to it. This book here is just brand new, out just a couple of months ago. It's another issue that's been on my heart quite a lot in the last number of years. Why do people stop believing? How many of you know somebody, a devoted Christian, who in the past was a devoted Christian, and for whatever reason has just walked away from the faith and no longer even identifies as a Christian today? How many of you have people like that? How many of you know people who were Christian leaders who are in that position. You see, that's what got to me. There's a whole wave of people like this. And I talked to a young man one day who encountered one of them, and he was going to share his faith with this person. The young man I'm talking about, the Christian young man. Well, he got such a blistering response and such a well-informed attack on his own position that he found himself on the defensive with virtually nothing to say to this person. This person understood the faith far better than he did, understood the problems with Christianity that he had piled up, and my friend had no response to those things. And I began to realize we have a much more well-informed and adamant critic out there. And a pastor came to me one day and said, "You've got to make that the topic of your next book." And that was a number of years ago, and I began thinking about it and eventually did. And this one had just come out, Why People Stop Believing. So that's on the back there. And it addresses a wave of Christian leaders and others who are walking away from the faith today. Why are they doing it? And what are the arguments that are now launching against Christianity? Because some of those are some of the most ardent and, as I say, well-informed ones. So those books are on the back table for you to have a look at and see if there's any there that would be of value to you. Our question this morning is, can we be good without God? The question I have on the title of that very first book. And it's a question that I have had freely asked to me. Maybe it's because I wrote the book with that title and have been involved in other discussions on that question as well. But I will say this, when you put that question out there, it's fairly provocative and gets a whole lot of different responses. And some of those responses are pretty emotional, as you can well imagine, pretty assertive, all the way from, well, no way, you can't be good without God, to way over here, yeah, you can, of course you can, and then a whole bunch in between as well. And I've heard a lot of those responses over the years. Now, I'll admit to you that the way you answer this question will depend partly on what you think the question means. If you think it means something different than somebody else, well, of course, you'd probably answer it differently as well, and that's part of what makes it provocative. But what I've found is our answer to this question, can we be good without God, depends upon a lot more than that. It depends upon stuff like what you think about God. What kind of God is he up there? How does God connect with us? Is there even a God in the first place? If you don't think there's a God in the first place, you're going to have a really quick answer to that question, can you be good without God, aren't you? It depends on what we think about goodness, moral goodness. What is moral goodness? How do we determine that? It also depends upon what we think about ourselves, about human nature. I've found the way we answer that question even depends upon what we see when we look around us in our society and in our world. And that leads me to what I'd like to do with us this morning. I'd like to put three questions to us this morning that deal with this one overall question, can we be good without God? Three sub-questions, and then three affirmations from God's revealed truth, three messages Christianity brings to the world, all relating to that overall question. So let's start with the three questions we have here today. And the first one is this: what do we see when we look around us in a search for moral goodness in our world? What do you see? I think we have a mixed bag, a pretty confusingly mixed bag, actually, because at times, tell me if I'm wrong when I say, we see our neighbors, our friends, who seem to be basically good people. They do things which look great to us. They're honest. They love their kids. They're good, helpful neighbors. You have a problem, they're there to help. You scratch their back, they scratch yours. You go on vacation, they watch your home and back and forth. Good people, regardless of whether they show any recognition of God or his existence or his presence. How many of you have neighbors just like that? You've had neighbors over the years. Because we have them just right now, neighbors just exactly like that. But you see, then there are other times when people around us in our society, in our world, don't look so good, do they? And of course, we can all point to the real well-known examples of the Adolf Hitlers of the world who murdered and tortured people on a grand scale. We can think about the Las Vegas shooter, remember about a year ago, who stood on the balcony blasting away, killing as many helpless people as he could, people who are running for their lives in the dark, not knowing where the bullets were coming from. We can think of the Paul Bernardos of the world, some of you may remember that name, committed heinous acts, torture, cruelty on young women. We can think of those horrendous instances of evil in our world. But you don't even have to look at something that gruesome. Consider the very obvious fact that we all have door locks on our homes. You have door locks. Is your home locked right now at the moment? Ours is. Door locks on our offices, on our cars, sometimes even multiple door locks. We have security systems, sometimes even bars on the windows. We have police forces. We have virus protection programs for our computers. We have legal systems. We have military forces. We have all these things. You look at that and you have to say to yourself, you know, something has gone seriously wrong here with the human race. Why do we need all these measures? Why do we need all these precautions? And how about this question? What are we saying about our society and about our neighbors with all these door locks and security systems and police forces? And what are they saying about us? Because they've got the same security systems on their homes as well. It seems to me that at the very least, we're saying that whatever good we may see out there, there is a level of evil running through the very heart of our society that touches all of us in some way. Listen to how the Old Testament prophet Jeremiah put this in a verse that I heard a long time ago, and I bet some of you know this verse as well. Book of Jeremiah, chapter 17, verse 9. It's an inescapable fact. He said, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked." As I heard Stuart Briscoe, some of you may know that name, a great preacher, a great pastor, say a number of years ago, talking about this very verse. He said, "We are able to rationalize to the point where we can convince ourselves that white is black and black is white. We can convince ourselves of just about anything we want to. The heart is deceitful above all things, desperately wicked." I think we give ourselves away every day by our actions and reactions. We show what's really inside. Speaking of reactions, I found myself really gripped by the story of a Transat airliner, an incident that I read about a number of years back. There's been a number of airline incidents in the last few years, haven't there? But here's one that I read about and a little further on, and some of you may know about this one as well. Transat airliner, 297 passengers plus crew on board, on their way to Portugal, but they were forced to land without power on a tiny island in the Atlantic Ocean, which the pilot found, because of a fuel leak. Okay? So, as I read the article, I thought to myself, you know, you've got to imagine what it would have been like inside that plane. Here you are over the Atlantic Ocean. How many of us have been over the Atlantic Ocean in a plane? Have we been there? Because I certainly have. Been there at least twice. Or some even number, because if it was an odd number, you'd still be over there somewhere, okay? And so at least that many times, here you are over the Atlantic Ocean, and on that plane, and suddenly at 6:26 a.m., everything goes perfectly silent. Is that what you want to hear when you're up there? Dead silence? Then the lights began to flicker. Then the plane began to plunge. Then it went into a rapid wave-like motion, up and down as it continued to plunge. As one passenger later said, it felt like a wild roller coaster ride. Here they were in the plane. Then they were told this, came over the intercom system, "The pilot is experiencing difficulties." Then they were told this, "Take off your shoes. Put on your life jackets." And here's what I call the euphemism of the century. "Prepare for a landing in the water." That's what they were told. You see, these people had an experience that few of us are ever going to get, because they looked death in the face. They really believed they were going to die, many of them, and yet they lived through it. Because suddenly, to everyone's amazement, they hit a runway that the pilot had been able to find on this tiny island in the Atlantic, but they hit this at 500 kilometers an hour with no power. Normal landing speed is closer to 200 kilometers an hour. And the plane slammed into the runway, ricocheted back up into the air, and back hitting the ground again. 8 tires blew out on impact, landing gear was damaged, a few people had minor injuries, but apart from that, everything on that plane was fine. Now, my question for all of us is this: how do you think you might have reacted if you'd been on that plane? I've thought about that since reading that article, and you see, even for me, even thinking about it has been a rather insightful exercise, because I dare say the real you and me would have come out on that plane. Well, consider the reactions of people who actually were on the plane. The article I read, as I walked through, I found 4 different reactions. The first one was instantaneous joy. They finally got their minds around the notion that they were alive and they were going to still be alive, and they all cheered. They broke out in an instantaneous cheer for the pilot and for themselves and for each other and for life itself. I got to tell you, I've never had that happen on any plane I've ever been on. Once it landed, no instantaneous cheer. Then there was a second reaction, profound gratitude. One passenger even said this, "I'm alive." Well, he was alive before. Why is he saying he's alive now? And then he said this, "I am reborn." How about that? And what's he saying with that? He's saying, I got a second chance at life. I get another shot at it. Because for this man, a safe landing was like coming back from the dead. Because as far as he was concerned, when that plane was plunging toward the earth, he was a dead man. Being alive was life. In his case, was like being reborn. The third reaction I found was this. There was an immediate common bond between the people on that plane. Perfect strangers jumped up and began hugging and kissing each other. Anybody here ever had that happen to you on an airplane? It happened to these people. Why? Because now, the people on that plane shared this profoundly moving, heart-wrenching experience with each other, which they shared with nobody else in the world. And it gave them a common bond, a bond with each other, which they shared with nobody else. And then came the fourth reaction. And this one, I have to say, caused me to shake my head. One man went around drumming up support for a class action lawsuit against Transat. Right there on the tarmac. Now, when I read that, I thought, is that really your first immediate reaction? I mean, isn't this a time for sheer joy that you're alive? I mean, thankfulness that the pilot got you down or something, anything more positive than a lawsuit, but not for this man, I guess. I'm assuming he probably figured, if I don't get these people together now, I'm not going to get these names, so we better get some names here. And maybe we shouldn't be too surprised, but you see, there you have it. When you look around, you see the good, you see the bad, you see the confusing. It's a pretty mixed bag, isn't it? And as sometimes I find it's hard to know what to make of it all, but in my mind it raises a far more important question. And that is this. It's not simply what we see when we look out there that matters. What's far more important is the question we're going to put as our second question today is this. What do we see when we look in here? Or more, even more importantly than that, what might God see? The omniscient, all-knowing, all-searching God of the universe, what might he see if he looked in here? You see, when we look out there, am I not correct in saying that to a great degree we see only what others want us to see? We see the image others project? You know why? You know why I'm pretty sure that's true? Because I think we all get pretty good at doing the very same thing. We ourselves get pretty good at projecting an image to others that we want them to see. And we all know, if we're honest, that there's a lot more going on in here than others can see out there. There's a story told of Socrates, the main character in the philosopher Plato's dialogues way back before the time of Jesus, about a man who came to town who claimed to be a specialist in seeing through people, in reading people's character. I wonder if you'd like to submit yourself to that person and see what you have to say about you. This man had never seen or heard of Socrates, and Socrates' disciples urged him to go see this man to allow the man to read Socrates' character, but more as a prank than anything else, because they were positive this man would never get it right with Socrates, since he was known as a man of such high moral character. He spent his entire life encouraging others to seek out the good, to do the good, unlike virtually everybody else that character reader would normally have read. So Socrates finally allowed it, and he stood before the man. And sure enough, the man pronounced Socrates to be a lustful, lazy lout, and a bully. And everybody began laughing. You know that gotcha laugh? We got you now. Okay, we've shown that you're a fraud. The trouble is, everybody there laughed except for Socrates. He said, stop laughing. This is no joke. This man is no con artist. He is right. These are precisely the temptations I struggle with daily. Now you see, I don't know how to verify whether that story is true or not, but the point of the story is this. He knew full well what was on the inside that no one else could see on the outside, and it came as a shock even to those who thought they knew Socrates well. And I guess I would just say this to you and to me here. You and I are in the very same situation, aren't we? Others look at us, even those who know us well, and they say, there's a great guy. There's a great gal. Honest, decent, real gentleman, friendly smile, high moral character. That's what they see. And yet they know nothing of what even you and I know of what's really there. How could they possibly know that? And more importantly, they know nothing about what God, the ultimate moral character, would know about the real you and me. Which leads us to our third question this morning, and that is this. How many of us, if we're honest, live up even to our own standards of what we know to be right or wrong? Never mind the moral standard that a God of ultimate moral perfection may have. This I find to be an interesting question, and I put this to different audiences over the years. Many non-Christians in universities that I've had an opportunity to speak to, I put the same question. How many of you, if you're honest, live up even to your own moral standard? Never mind whatever moral standard there might be that a God of ultimate moral perfection might have. And I've never yet had anybody say, yeah, I do. Everybody, when they think it through, realize, you know, I actually don't. You see, in one sense, we don't even hardly need that debate about whether or not there's a God there who has an ultimate standard of moral perfection which we may have violated, because we already have a sense of right and wrong. We understand what it means to be good and evil. We recognize it, whether we see it in others or we see it in ourselves. And even by that standard, our own standard, we haven't even lived up. We know that. So where do we go from here? If we haven't measured up even to our own moral standards and we know that, then where do we go? I think there's no better place to go than to God's revealed truth and see what he says about our question here, can we be good without God? So let's just put three messages out on the table today that God is telling the world about this question. Let's put them on the table, three messages from Christianity. And the first one is this, that we all do, in fact, know what it means to be good and evil, and our actions are a mixture of both. We know what good and evil is, and our actions are a mixture of both. And I say that whether we've had great moral instruction, which I imagine many of us in this room have, or whether we've had poor moral instruction, which some people in the world get. I say whether we've read the Bible or some other moral treatise or not. We all know the difference between good and evil because God, the creator of the universe, has placed within the psyche, the mind of every person he's created, a knowledge of good and evil. Look how Paul put this. In Romans chapter 2, you can listen to what he says here. Romans 2, verses 14 and 15. Really insightful passages, which maybe we don't think about enough. Verses, which we don't maybe think about enough. But Paul is talking here about the Gentile nations, people who did not have the prophets, the law, anything from Moses. They didn't have any of that information at all. And yet, look what Paul says about what they have. He says, indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law, they are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law. Well, how can that be? He goes on to say, since they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them. What's the point Paul's making here with this? We'll come back and read a couple of other passages right close to that one in a few moments. What's the point Paul's making here? He's talking about people who did not have the moral teachings of the Bible, the teachings from the prophets giving the messages from God. They didn't have any of that. And yet, Paul can say, they had the law of God written on their hearts. They had a moral conscience, which sometimes commended their actions when they acted in accordance with it, and other times it condemned them when they did not. And I'll bet that's our experience as well. Well, if that's true, if there is a moral standard coming from a morally perfect God, and we all have it written on our hearts, then comes the second message from Christianity, from God to the world, which is this, we're not all okay. You see, I say that because we sometimes, maybe in jest, but maybe some with a point as well, we make statements like that. I'm kind of okay. In fact, I'm a lot better than some other people I can think of. Or you're okay too. But hey, we're all kind of okay here. You see, those kinds of statements may sound like they have merit, especially if we take a very selective look at certain human actions and compare ourselves with people who are, of course, worse. We can do that. And we shut our eyes off to other actions. But the fact is, you and I all know that when you take a hard, honest look at the human race and the record of human activity, it's not all okay, is it? We don't have door locks and security systems and police forces. We don't have halfway houses and shelters for battered women and abused children because we're all okay. We don't have conferences on battling crime. We don't have degree programs called criminology degrees because we're all okay. We have these things because something is wrong at the very heart of the human race, not just out there, but it's in here. Notice how Paul put this when he took a good, honest look at human character and human actions and judge them by God's standard of moral perfection. Listen to this. Romans chapter 3, I'm reading verse 10 on. Romans 3, verse 10. He's quoting from the Old Testament here as well, but look what he says here. Speaking about the human race in general, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. These are categorical statements he's making. Their throats are open graves. Look at the pictures here. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways, and the way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. When I read that statement, the way of peace they do not know, I'm reminded of a fact I heard a number of years ago. And that is that since 1945, the end of World War II, the world has actually known 5 days free of conflict. 5 days. There's been conflict of some kind going on in the world virtually every day since World War II. And I'm looking at this statement by Paul that he wrote 2,000 years ago. And when I read everything else Paul says, I'm tempted to say, wow, are you not overdoing that just a little bit, Paul? I mean, are we really in that bad a shape, making all those categorical statements? And you see, judging ourselves by our own changing standards, we can sometimes make ourselves come out looking pretty good. I'm okay. You're okay. But things are different when the moral spotlight from the Creator of the universe shines on us. But you see, if that's true, if we never are going to achieve moral goodness on our own, then I guess it raises this question, is it all hopeless then? Do we just give it up? Well, I read something from C.S. Lewis on this very question a number of years back, and I thought that he shed some real insight on this, gave some real interesting way of putting this, because Lewis said this, it's only at this point that Christianity actually has something to say to us, when we recognize two foundational truths of reality. And what are they? The first is, there is an ultimate moral standard of right and wrong, what he called the law of human nature. There is that, it exists. And number two, we do not live up to it. If you read Mere Christianity, that's the first part of that book. When you are able to accept those two statements, then Christianity steps in to speak to you, but not before that. And what it tells you is this. There is a way to achieve goodness, but it's a different kind of goodness. It's a surprising kind. It's not through you and me. I suppose that's pretty obvious by now. Nothing we will ever do will get us there. If it's going to happen, it's going to have to come from somewhere else. And Scripture tells us that is Christ. That is Jesus, the Son of God, the only morally perfect human being who ever lived, who died on that cross in our place, who received the penalty we should have received for the sins we committed, because he didn't commit any. He was without sin. And he offers to us his own moral goodness, his own moral righteousness as a free gift when we simply reach out and receive that gift by faith. The wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life, Romans chapter 6. And then it says in there that God declares us to be perfectly righteous with the righteousness of Jesus put to our account. Let's not think that God has turned a blind eye to evil and sin that is in the world. He hasn't. It's been paid for with a very costly price, the death of his own son. But you see, here's the amazing part about this, and that's what we call it good news. When we reach out and receive this gift of forgiveness and righteousness, from then on, when God, and I mean the morally perfect creator of the universe, when he looks at you and he looks at me, what does he see? Well, here's what he does not see. He does not see your sin, your immorality, or mine. He does not see the times we've messed up. He doesn't see the evil that even you know is there. These have all been paid for by Christ, forgiven by God, and get this, biblical word, Old Testament and New Testament. These sins and the time we've messed up have been forgotten by God. Intentionally forgotten by God. The book of Hebrews and the book of Jeremiah. You know, I came across a story a number of years back. Some of you may have seen this as well. I've heard this more than once, but I believe Philip Yancey writes about this in one of his books, about a seminary student who committed some act of immorality while he was a student. He woke up the next day racked with guilt. He went before God, pled for forgiveness, and he tried to believe he was forgiven, but still, he had this horrible guilt, this horrible pain which would not go away. He'd committed this act, he knew it, he couldn't change that fact, he couldn't forget it. Well, he went on anyway, became a full-fledged minister in his own church, and one day somebody came to him and said, you know, we have a woman in our church who claims that she speaks with God, and God answers her back. The pastor said, I'd like to meet that woman. So they introduced the two, and the man said, the pastor asked, is this true what they say about you? And she said, yes, it is. And the pastor said, well, then could you ask God a question for me? And she said, yes. And what is your question? The pastor said, could you simply ask God, what was my sin in seminary? The woman said, okay, I will. Next week they came back, and the pastor immediately sought her out and said, well, did you ask God that question? She said, yes. He said, what did he say? She looked at him and said, God told me he's forgotten. Now, I'm not sure what you think about that, answer, but you know what the woman's point was? If God's forgotten it, then isn't it about time you let it go as well? And Hebrews chapter 8, verse 12 does say, I will forgive their wickedness and remember their sins no more. Hebrews 10:17 says the very same thing, taken from the book of Jeremiah. Well, you see, maybe some of us can relate. Something we did or said a long time ago. It hangs around our necks like an albatross. It cripples us. We just can't forget it. Well, the point is, and I know this is metaphorical language because God's an omniscient God. In one sense, he knows all things. We know that. But let's not downplay the point that's being made, because the Bible chose the word, forgot, does not remember. What the Bible's telling us here is if God has intentionally removed this from his conscious awareness, it will never come up again. When he looks at you, he doesn't see that. Well, then isn't it about time we let it go as well? And when God sees us now, he sees us clothed with the goodness and the righteousness of Jesus as a child in whom he delights and whom he will never leave. That's why it's called good news. And that's the good news that the Christian gospel has to bring to the world. Let me just read you how Paul says the very same thing I said in the four verses, Romans chapter 3, verses 21 to 24. If you ever want to have four verses that you memorize and know through and through and think about like once a week, these would be the ones. Romans 3, 21 to 24, it says, "But now a righteousness from God apart from law." In other words, apart from achieving it through doing good things. "A righteousness from God apart from law has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. This righteousness from God comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There is no difference." So how do you get it? It's not through the law. It's through faith in Jesus. "For there is no difference, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus." Let's bow together in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, I thank you so much that you have given us such clarity on such important matters. I thank you for the gospel. I thank you for the word of God that you've given to us, but I thank you for the gospel. I thank you for your grace and for your mercy. And this comes at us every single day. And we have a message that's the greatest message the world could ever hear. I pray that you will give us confidence in it, give us joy, help us to communicate with others around us, and to be stirred by how important and how valuable and how powerful this is for the people around us and even for us today. In your name we pray. Amen.